Well, good morning. It's absolutely great to be here. Thank you to all those who've had a part in having us here. Thanks to folk at Charlotte Chapel, Paul Rees, Ian for all the amazing organisation he's done, and lots of others too. It is great to be in Britain's most beautiful city. Sorry to those who come from Glasgow, which is also a lovely city, and anywhere else. I must apologise at once for my accent. One thing I can say is that of the 10 children that the speakers today have, three of them were born in Scotland. So that's one each, but it doesn't quite work out that way. The question we've got to begin with is, have we got the history right? Can we trust the history of the New Testament? When it tells us about Jesus, can we rely on it? C.S. Lewis, the author of the famous Narnia series an expert on English literature, said, really, when you look at the New Testament, you've got a choice of either thinking that Jesus is a lord, liar, or lunatic. You could call it his trilemma. How did he get to that? He got to that because he said the sort of things that Jesus says about himself in the Gospels are so great that either they must be true, he's lord, or if he or he has to be a liar, or he's mad because there's no other explanation. However, there is a fourth explanation which has become very popular recently, and that is that it's all legend. That if Jesus really said those things, of course his trilemma would work, but do we really know that Jesus did say those things in the first place? Isn't it the case that over long periods of time, as people have passed on the message, that it's changed? And so people have the idea of scribes changing the text that we have. Or maybe it's like Chinese whispers, where as words get passed on, they change. Well, we're going to be looking at that topic today. But I want us to begin with some of the things that non-Christian writings say about the beginnings of Christianity. Why would I do that? Well, people who are non-Christians are often more prepared to give credence to what a non-Christian writes. They don't seem to have a case for wanting to prop up Christianity. At the same time, you shouldn't expect there to be as much by non-Christians about the beginnings of Christianity. Most writing about football is by people who are interested in football. I mean, that just is the way it is. There is less by people not interested. So most writing about early Christianity is by people interested in Christianity, and particularly by Christians. You shouldn't discount their witness because of that. But let's begin with what we can say from some non-Christian writings. And I'm just going to give you a selection of some of the things that we find. I want us to begin with a Roman writer called Cornelius Tacitus. And he is born around the year 56 in Rome. I should say all the slides today are going to be available on a website later, at least for 1 week before they're taken down. So in case people want to take notes, you can be assured. Around the year 56, he's born, and at age 8... an event happened in AD 64 when there was a great fire in Rome, and Nero is thought to have started that. Nero was a bit of a mad emperor. And so he decided that rather than go down in the polls, he would blame the Christians for having started the fire. And that's where Tacitus breaks into his story. He describes what happened in the aftermath of the fire in Rome. Now, the thing about Tacitus is people are prepared to trust him for something that happened outside his hometown many, many years before. He is writing about something that happened in his hometown of Rome in his own lifetime, albeit he was young. But this is something which was well attested. This is what it says. But neither help by humans, nor generous gifts from the emperor, the bribes by Nero, nor all the ways of placating heaven could stifle the scandal or dispel the belief that the fire had taken place by order, in other words, order of Nero. Therefore, to scotch the rumour, Nero substituted as culprits and punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd styled Christians. Now, already, the quotation goes on, but already just from that, we can tell quite a few things. The word Christian is an interesting word because Christian presupposes a word like Christ, that you're someone who follows Christ. And Christ is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew word Messiah. The Messiah is the person that the Jews are expecting to come and deliver them. So if there's a group called Christians, that already tells you something about their beliefs. They must be a group of people who believe that the Jewish Messiah has already come. The other interesting thing is that the crowd are the people who call the Christians Christians, not that the Christians self-designate as Christians. Interestingly, the three times that the word Christian occurs in the New Testament, twice in the book of Acts and once in 1 Peter, it is used as outsider language. Outsiders define Christians as that, not Christians defining themselves. And that happens, it seems, to fit with the early stage of Christianity. After a little while, of course, Christians begin to designate themselves as Christians. It's a bit like Methodists. At first, Methodist was a term just used by outsiders to describe Methodists. Then Methodists started calling themselves Methodists. That's the same sort of thing we've got going on here. So, in fact, just this fits with the New Testament in terms of showing the New Testament occurrences to be early. But it says a bit more. Christus, Latin for Christ, the founder of the name, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius. Now, Tiberius reigned from the year 14 to the year 37. So already we know something about when Christ was executed by the sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was procurator from the year 26 to the year 36. And the pernicious superstition was checked for a moment, only to break out once more, not merely in Judea, the home of the disease, but in the capital, Rome itself, where all things horrible or shameful in the world collect together and become fashionable. So obviously he loved the town that he lived in. But what we notice here, he really doesn't like Christianity at all, but he confirms the geographical origin of Christianity, namely that it began in Judea, and roughly confirms the chronology of the beginnings of Christianity, that the founder, Christ, had undergone the death penalty sometime between the year 26 and 36. We're in the year 64, and Christianity has spread all of that distance. Now, the distance between Judea and Jerusalem and Rome is roughly the same as the distance between Rome and the top of the Shetland Islands. Okay, just to give you a sense of distance. And of course, you know that if you do go overland, it's going to be a little bit of a longer way. And so Christianity has spread far and fast. That is significant. Then he says, first then, confessed members of the sect were arrested. Next, on their disclosures, vast numbers were convicted, not so much on account of arson as for hatred of the human race. You know, Christians hate people. You ever come across that thing? Well, there it was that back then. And derision accompanied their end. They were covered with wild beast skins and torn to death by dogs, or they were fastened on crosses, and when daylight failed, were burned to serve as lamps by night. What you get from this account is quite a lot. Vast numbers of Christians in Rome. Christianity spread far, fast, and there are large numbers. If you read the book of Acts, which is the New Testament's account of the spread of Christianity, you find the same pattern. Christianity spreads far, and of course, the common theme that Christians are persecuted. So that's just to give you a sense of the spread. Come to a second witness. This time it's Pliny, who is governor of northwest Turkey, a place called Bithynia, around the year 112. He is writing to the emperor himself, and he writes the emperor asking for advice on how to deal with Christians. The emperor already knows about Christians, and so he decides to ask the emperor for advice. And he says, I interrogated them, these Christians, as to whether they were Christians. If they confessed, I interrogated them a second and a third time, threatening punishment. If they persisted, I ordered them to be led off, namely to execution. As for those who denied that they were or ever had been Christians, when they invoked the gods in words given by me and prayed with incense and wine offerings to your statue, which I had ordered to be brought for this very purpose, along with the images of the gods, and also cursed Christ, which it said that no true Christian can ever be compelled to do, I thought they should be discharged. Now, Pliny's a nice guy. You see, Pliny is such a moderate. The extremists would say, bump off anyone who's ever been called a Christian. And Pliny just says, no, bump off the people who persist as Christians. Let's let the others off. That's his moderation, you see. And he's writing to the emperor to confirm whether this moderate line of approach with Christianity is actually legitimate, or whether you should just, you know, anyone who's ever gets denounced as a Christian, you should kill them straight away. So, as you can see, it's very easy for Christians back then. So what he says is there were these tests that he has for whether people are Christians. And one of the things you notice about these tests is the test of whether someone's Christian is whether they're prepared to worship anything else other than the Christian God. In other words, we can tell something about Christian theology from this. These people only believed in one God. And he has this fascinating phrase, curse Christ, which it said that no true Christian can ever be compelled to do. Here, about 80 years after the beginnings of Christianity, a non-Christian writer is already distinguishing in his mind between a true Christian and a Christian in name only, which is, of course, a very important distinction to make. So here we have Christians having a very hard time. Then he talks about a document which denounced some people and listed some people as Christians. Others named in the document said that they were Christians but later denied it, saying that they had been, but that they had ceased 3 years ago or many years ago or even as much as 20. They said that this had been the full extent of their guilt or error. They've been accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn, which of course is a bad time for a church meeting, and to sing antiphonally, one side of to the other, a song to Christ as to a God, and to bind themselves by an oath, not to some crime, but rather not to commit theft, robbery, or adultery, not to break their trust, and not to refuse to return a pledge when asked to do so. Now here, we're around the year 112, could be 111, sometime when he's governor, around then, he's talking about what people who have ceased being Christians used to do in their meetings 3 years ago, many years ago, as much as 20. So this is a description of what went on in a Christian meeting 20 years before the time that he's writing, you see, which gets you back into the first century, in the 90s. Here we have a non-Christian describing what went on in these Christian meetings, and you see there's an emphasis on honesty and so on. But one of the key things is that they sang to Christ as to a God. Now, we've already just seen that a key test of being a Christian is that they're not prepared to worship the emperor. Christians don't just worship any old being. Christianity worships only one God. And so what we see is clearly this means they understand Christ as God. By the way, there's no word a in Latin, so whether it's Christ to as a God or God, you can't tell from the text. But think about this, a bit of maths. How many gods do Jews believe in? Anyone? One. Okay. Christianity began amid Judaism. Now, there's a mathematical rule in Jewish theology that goes, there can only be one God. Okay? Now, in Greek theology, you can have lots of gods. You can have Percy Jackson, you can have half god, quarter god. You know, when a god looks down from the sky, sees a nice young girl, gets together with her, what do they produce? Half god. Okay? That's what you get. And mathematically, there is no limit to the set of how many gods you can have. And a lot of the way people sometimes talk about the beginnings of Christianity is something like this. At first, Christians thought that Jesus was really special. Then they thought he was really, really special. Then he was really, really, really special. Then he was halfway to God. Then eventually, over time, three-quarters of the way, then all the way up there. The only problem is that it presupposes that there is some sort of step of halfway to God that a Jewish group could believe in. But one of the things that seems presupposed by this is actually that there is no such step. For those who have come from Judaism and Christianity begins amid Judaism, then there is only one God. And so the only way you can worship Christ, the only way you can worship Jesus is by identifying him as that one God, not by gradually over time exalting him to be that one God. So in the Dan Brown version of the story, they wait 300 years and then they decide to give Jesus the promotion from from human to God. But here, we have a non-Christian document showing already that Jesus is being worshipped as God back then. Then he continues, many people of every age and every rank and of both sexes are being and will be called to trial. Nor is it only the cities that are affected, but the disease of this superstition is also reaching villages and farmsteads. It seems possible to check and correct this. It's pretty well agreed that the temples, which had almost become deserted, have now begun to be frequented again. And the sacred rites, which have been neglected for a long time, are recommencing, and the flesh for sacrificial rites is being sold, for which, up to now, it was hard to find a purchaser. Here we have the governor of northern Turkey writing to the emperor, saying that in his area, so many people have become Christians that the temples are almost deserted. That's the economic effect of Christianity on this place that Paul never evangelized. You see, read the book of Acts, Acts chapter 19. There's a big riot because of the economic effects of Christianity on people who make idols. People aren't buying them anymore. So in other words, we've got the same sort of picture. And then, it's not just that Christianity has spread far and fast, we also see Christianity has spread from a place where the facts were well known. I want to come to a final non-Christian writer before I try and tie up some conclusions from this. This non-Christian writer is Josephus, who's born around the year 36, dies around the year 100, and he writes about what happens AD 61, when there's a power vacuum in Jerusalem, when the governor, there's no governor, and so the high priest, Ananus, seizes power. And this is what happens. Ananus assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before it the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, and when he had made an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he handed them over to be stoned. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, this one isn't someone who is a long way away from the beginnings of Christianity. He was in the very town where it all began. And he talks about Jesus having a brother called James. Well, Mark chapter 6, verse 3, you read that Jesus had a brother called James. That fits with the New Testament, and you can read in the book of Acts about how he was a leader in the early church. And here we have an account of how he died for his faith. Well, do you think you would be able to persuade your brother or sister that you are the son of God? Anyone on that? Maybe if you're David Icke, maybe you've got your family and they're prepared to come on TV with you and say that they think you're the son of God. But are they willing to die for it? This is the striking thing. We've got people dying for it far away, people dying for it close at hand. Some people have this idea that gradually over time, the message must have changed. Major parts of it would have been made up. But here we got family members in at the beginning. You might say, well, that makes it even more of a conspiracy. But these people are paying a big price. The idea, for instance, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Some people say, well, what's happened is the New Testament has made that bit up to fit with a prophecy in the Old Testament, which says that the future ruler of Israel is going to come and be born in Bethlehem. Therefore, it's written it in order to fit with the prophecy. And at first glance, that could make a lot of sense. But there are some problems. You see, one of the key problems is, when did they make that story up? You see, if they make it up really early on, then you've got family members around. Now, I'm the youngest of three brothers, but I still think I know where my elder brothers were born, because it's the sort of thing you were told early on in family. So you've got family members around who are paying a high price for it. But then if it's made up later on, the problem is this. Christianity has spread so far. If you've been telling people for the first 30 years of Christianity, as it explodes out across the Mediterranean, that Jesus was born in Nazareth, and then you say, actually, we need to change the story now, he was born in Bethlehem, it's not really going to work. Because you've got no centralized structure, you've got no means of spreading and changing the message. It can't be done. And so it's like trying to change a publicity campaign after it started. That's not the way things work. In fact, we see when we read letters in the New Testament how difficult it was for Paul to get a church that he had founded to agree with him at times. The thought that you could go and get all of the churches with all of their divisions to agree with you on a particular point after Christianity has spread just doesn't work. Christians were divided early on. That's actually an argument for Christianity, namely that the common beliefs that they all have go back to the point before they were divided. So the thing that we find across Christian and non-Christian writings, the agreement that early Christianity spread far and fast, and it was very difficult to be a Christian. And that's just three sources that I've considered. There are other ones. I want to now to come to Christian writings and to consider them. And the question we're going to look at, particularly with reference to the Gospels and Acts, is do they know the place and time they're writing about? We could test and see, do Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, the four Gospels in the New Testament, know when they talk about the agriculture of a particular place, the botany and culture, and so on. What am I testing for with that? Well, you might not be able to find particular evidence of an event, but you can at least say, were these stories made up on a French island by someone a long way away, or are they based on information that's come close to hand? Now, they could, someone could have lots of information which is close to hand and still be making up the story, at least we can say that initially. But we can ask the question, do they have that close-up knowledge at all? And I want to introduce a test which has been looked at recently, which is a test of personal names. What are characters in the Gospels actually called? There's been some remarkable work done by Richard Borkham, who is professor of New Testament at St. Andrews, just in the last decade, building on the work, a most boring work, which is just basically, no, not his work, someone else's work, which was a list of all of the things that people were called at the time. It's like a telephone directory, and it looked at gravestones and bone boxes and historical records and said, let's just list everything that everyone was called. But then you gather it together and you say, well, we got these 3,000 Jewish personal names of names of people in Israel, and what you find is you can do some statistics with them and find how much the Gospels and Acts correlate with these. Let's look at this. Outside the New Testament, 15 or 16% of men were called one of the top two names, Simon or Joseph. If you're a Palestinian Jewish man, one of two names. Inside the New Testament is about 18%. That's pretty close, because that's a pattern we're finding out over four different writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, writing five different books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. Excluding Gentile characters like Pilate, they don't count. We're just looking at Jewish men who live in Palestine. The top nine men's names, group them together, and you find 40% or 41% outside the New Testament, inside the New Testament. Very close. The bigger the data sample gets, the closer the numbers become. With women's names, the data sample's smaller. But we find the top woman's name inside the New Testament is Mary. The most frequent woman's name outside the New Testament is Mary. Less imagination here in giving women names. 29% of women had one of those top two names outside the New Testament. In fact, it's 39% in the Gospels and Acts. And the top nine women's names, about 50% of women were called one of those names. And it's about 61% in the Gospels and Acts. What we can see is there's basically a pretty good correlation there. Top name outside the New Testament, Simon. Top name inside the New Testament, Simon. Second name outside the New Testament, Joseph. Second name inside the New Testament, Joseph. That is a correlation which we're finding between the Gospels and statistics that have only been known within the last decade. So it's a pretty striking thing. Because if someone were making up a story on a French island, or wherever it is, in Rome, decide, let's make up some characters, how are they going to know what people are called? In fact, when we list them out by numbers of individuals, we see, well, in Palestine, you get one pattern with names, but there are lots of Jews in Egypt. And Jews in Egypt have a different pattern of names. In there, at number two on the charts, is Sabbataias. In Palestine, that's 68th equal in rank. Now, question here. Does anyone know anyone called Sabbataias? No? Not even a dog? Born on the Sabbath day? Okay. So what we find is that's a common name in Egypt. It's not a common name in the Gospels because they're not about Jewish men in Egypt. And that's why they haven't passed on into Western culture as names that people call people. Pappus, Ptolemaeus. Again, they look obscure and odd to us. And Simon's not in the top list. You see, it's a different category of name. Now, if I said, I want you to make up a story about, you know, a whole load of characters in Libya 100 years ago, would you be able to give them the right character? Well, you might know Megrahi or Gaddafi as Libyan names, but would you get things in the right statistics? Sorry, I didn't mean to get touch on sensitive things. Just you would happen to know these are names, but would you be able to say that these sort of Arab names are common to Libya, but you've got a different pattern in Egypt and so on, you'd have no idea. In fact, you'd have enough difficulty with your own culture. A lot of people have this experience, that they name a child what they think is quite an unusual name, and then they find, straight after naming the child, that there are loads of them. Any hands raised up for that experience? And why is that? Because our intuitions, even in our olden culture, of what common names are not entirely reliable. Because they're probably based on a sample of really hundreds of names rather than thousands that we keep in our minds. So even if you were to make up a story about the culture you live in now, you might not get the right sort of name pattern. But there's a further aspect. You see, if there are so many people called Simon, then you call out Simon, and lots of people turn their head, don't they? So you've got a problem. You need to disambiguate, you know, that Wikipedia phrase. So what we need to do is distinguish one Simon from another. Well, think about it. Jesus had 12 disciples, two of whom were called Simon. One is Simon, called Peter or Cephas. The other is Simon, called the Zealot or the Canaanite. In other words, you add something onto the name. Could be a job, where they come from, father's name. Doesn't matter. Something to tell one Simon from another. You see? I mean, I think this is a common feature where you have too many names, you know, too many McLeods or whatever it is. Sorry, the McLeods out there. You know, too many names just clustering together. You find ways of distinguishing one from another, don't you? And this is exactly what happens. So Simon of Cyrene carries the cross. Simon the leper that Jesus has a meal with, but he's not a leper at the time because people are sitting around having a meal with him. Maybe Jesus healed him. But he's called that to distinguish him from other Simons. You see? And that's the way the Gospels work. Mary Magdalene. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. You see, they add something extra to the name. And basically, in the New Testament, they do that to all the most popular names in Palestine and not any of the others. So what you can see is, if someone were writing the story a long way away, they're going to tell it rather differently. But there's a further aspect of this. Does any of you ever struggle with remembering names? Now, let's be honest. Have a moment of honesty, please. Anyone struggle remembering names? Yeah? Okay. Now, why do we struggle to remember names? Well, basically because there's very rarely any logical reason for someone to be called that name. You know, the link between the name and the person is a bit arbitrary. In fact, there are sometimes good logical reasons why someone should not be called that name. But that's another issue. So names are hard to remember. And we can, in fact, tell all sorts of things about people. But not their name. So sometimes you will know, there might be someone even here, and you know where they came from, you know how many brothers and sisters they've got, what car they drive. You can remember the conversation you had with them, you can't remember their name. You know? Names are hard to remember. You watch a film, you remember what happens in the film, you remember what the minor characters do, you forget the names of the minor characters, you might even forget the names of the major characters. Because names drop out, but stories stick in the mind. So think about this. If the Gospels have correctly got the detail, which is the hardest thing to remember, isn't there every reason to think they could get the other things right? You see, remembering who was with whom and where they were is easy relative to remembering names. And names, in fact, drop out of stories. They don't get added in. You go on holiday, something exciting happens, you meet some people, you come back, you tell them the story, you think, am I going to put in the names of the people I met, if I can remember them, to the people I tell them the story to? No, you tell them the story. There were some people I met on holiday, and this, you know, that's what you say. And so, this idea that what we have in the Gospels has in fact passed through stage after stage after stage, like Chinese whispers of transmission, and has been corrupted on the way, just doesn't work. The way the names are tells us we've got this early on in transmission. In other words, what we've got is something close to eyewitness testimony. Now, I want to look at a few examples from the Gospels. Firstly, I give you the list of disciples as they are in Matthew's Gospel. And I have put in brackets the number, the rank of that name, if it's in the top 99 Palestinian Jewish male names. And what you find is, if it's a high-ranking name, it has a qualification. if it's a low-ranking name. It doesn't. Peter called, Simon called Peter, and Andrew his brother. You know Andrew is someone else's brother, so that defines which Andrew you're talking about. Andrew's not ranked anyway, it's a bit rare name. But James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. Philip, low-ranking. Bartholomew, low-ranking, no qualification. Thomas, not even in the top 99, no qualification. Matthew, higher, the tax collector. James, higher, the son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, lower, no qualification. Simon, higher, the Cananean. Judas, higher, Iscariot, who also betrayed him. Now, I know there are other things going on with a list like that. But to me, when I look at this list, this looks like a list not as someone would create a list were they in another country. This list looks to me like something which serves a purpose in the very country that these people come from. Or consider the name John. John was a common name, and you have a figure called John the Baptist, and you call him John the Baptist to tell you that he's not any other John. But what we find is, say in the Gospel of Matthew, that Herod, when he hears what the miracles Jesus has been doing, he thinks it's John the Baptist. So he says to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He doesn't just say this is John, because his servants would say, which John was that? We've got several Johns that work in your palace. That's not very helpful. But then the narrator continues and said, so Herod sees John. So the character speaks one way, the narrator speaks another way. Again, John said. But then Herodias' daughter wants the head of John the Baptist, and she has to add the Baptist, otherwise she might get the wrong head. You see? So, and then the narrator continues, so he sent him a headed John. So here we have characters speaking the way people ought to have spoken then. The way it would have been necessary, but not necessary in another context. Now, you could say, well, that doesn't show that this is actually what they said. It shows we've got a very clever narrator. Fine. But the cleverer you make the narrator, the harder it is to say they got things wrong through bungling incompetence. So let's just remember that people choose one of two routes sometimes with Christianity, either to say they were very clever and conspired, or they were very stupid and got it wrong through bungling incompetence. Let's remember there is a little bit of a tension between those two approaches. Take the name Jesus. Jesus is actually a popular name. There are six most popular names. So you get other Jesuses in the New Testament, Jesus called Justice, and so on. And here, we find that if we just look at the way the name Jesus occurs in the Gospels, it occurs in different ways in the four Gospels. So just to do a bit of number crunching here, the numbers of words in the four Gospels is roughly as follows. You can see Mark's the shortest, Luke's the longest of the Gospels. We then put in the number of names of Jesus, and we actually find that John has the most. We factor numbers of names over Jesus over length, and we find that Luke has the fewest, proportionate to every 1,000 words. John has the most. Now, all I'm trying to demonstrate at that point is that they use the name Jesus differently from each other. Nothing more. Okay? Because that's a foundation for something I'm going to show you, how they all use the name Jesus in the same way, despite the fact that they use it differently. How's it go? Well, what you see again is Jesus in narrative is just called Jesus generally. They might add something, but they don't have to. But Jesus in speech is something different. The crowds can't say, hey, Jesus is coming down the road, because the question is, which Jesus? There are tons of Jesuses around. So they say this is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth in Galilee. They add something. But then the narrator says Jesus went into the temple. So the crowd speaks the way they would have to speak in Palestine, but not in Rome, not in Turkey. Do you see? Then we could look, the narrator continues, Matthew 26. Jesus said to him, but when we have in a speech, servant girl comes up to Peter, who's about to deny Jesus, and says, you were with Jesus the Galilean. She adds something extra. Then a servant girl, who's a little bit more clued up, comes up and said, you were with Jesus of Nazareth. But then Peter simply remembers the saying of Jesus. You see, narrator speaks, writes one way, characters another way. And then it continues. Pilate talks to the crowd. Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Christ? You can't just say Barabbas or Jesus, because they say, which Jesus? You've got several Jesuses in your prison. You know, maybe, I don't know. But so there is some what shall I do with Jesus who has gone Christ on the cross? Jesus, King Jesus, even the angel, I know you're looking for Jesus, who was crucified. Just to tell you, you know, that's not everyone has been crucified. So that's the way Matthew does it. Now, without giving you the counter examples, I'll show you the same pattern in Luke, in Mark. Every time you get Jesus in a crowd setting, in speech, it's got something extra. Jesus of Nazareth, son of David, Jesus, because not every Jesus descends or claims descent from Jesus. The Nazarene Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, you see. And then I go to Luke, and I find the same thing happening. Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus, son of the Most High God, Jesus, teacher. Not every Jesus is a rabbi. Jesus, son of David. Now, you might think there's a counterexample in Luke 23, thief on the cross, Jesus, remember me. But of course, in that case, it's not a crowd situation. So there's no need for that disambiguation. And when on the road to Emmaus, the two people meet Jesus but don't know he's Jesus, they don't just say the things concerning Jesus, because there were lots of Jesuses. They say the things concerning Jesus of Nazareth. Now, this might be all be going a bit fast for you. If you haven't read the Gospels before, they're a great read. I just encourage you to go away and look and see how you can find these things. And then we find the same happening in John's Gospel. So although we've shown the four Gospels use the name Jesus in different ways, different numbers of times, they have this common feature. So you can't say, well, one person has taken care of editing them all. They've got such different style. They can't all be one by one person. No one who studies them thinks they're all by one person. No, they're all so different. And yet, they have this feature running through them. We found Jesus, the son of Joseph, from Nazareth. Then we have a case where someone says, Jesus, son of Joseph. So then John 9, the man called Jesus made clay. Well, is that a counterexample because there's no extra specifier? No. This is a story of a man who's healed from blindness. And what happens is the story illustrates first how he is healed of physical blindness and how through the narrative he comes to see who Jesus really is. And here he's early on in the story where it's still showing his spiritual ignorance. The point is, he knows he's been healed physically, but he doesn't yet know properly the person who's healed him. So they ask him, who's healed you? And he says, well, there's a man called Jesus. He doesn't really know much about him. You know, someone called Fred. It's nothing more than that. So again, in the garden, whom are you looking for? Jesus of Nazareth. That's a pattern that shows up in all four Gospels. And that's the sort of thing which I would expect if people are really reporting what people said. Now, we can contrast this with the way some apocryphal Gospels, Simon will be looking at a little bit later, and Dirk as well, these Gospels that get a lot of coverage in the media, oh, we've discovered a new Gospel, maybe we should stick this in the Bible. Well, let's just take a calm look today at some of these apocryphal Gospels, Gospel of Thomas and so on, and look at their names. And you find, well, actually, they haven't got very Jewish ways of doing things. Mary, very common name with no qualifier. Didymus, Judas, Thomas, which means twin, Judas, twin, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. The Gospel of Mary doesn't even call Jesus Jesus. It just calls him the Saviour all the time. And you don't even know which Mary it's writing. I mean, Mary, the most common name for women in Palestine, the Gospel of Mary. Well, is it Mary, Mother of Jesus? Mary Magdalene? Who knows? It's just Mary. You know, you might try and get it from her character, but it's difficult to be sure from the name. And then the Gospel of Judas. Well, it's got two characters with Palestinian names. One is called Judas, and the other one is called Jesus, and then it's got a whole load of figures from outer space. So, you know, again, not very impressive knowledge of place and time. Okay, so my conclusion is this, that the pattern we've got for personal names in the Gospels is the sort of pattern you'd expect them to have if they're true, and it would be very difficult and very complex for a forger to make that up. Doesn't mean I've proven this is true. I'm not saying here today I can prove it to be true. If you want to disbelieve, you can disbelieve. There is always room for disbelief if you want to disbelieve. But there are good reasons to believe. I want to do another test, the test of geography. Do they know the places they write about? Well, if you look at the Gospels, you find the most common place they talk about is Jerusalem, followed by Nazareth, as in Jesus of, followed by Capernaum, which is the other place that Jesus lived. But in addition to those places, we also get a number of villages, some of which are pretty small places. Bethany, Bethsaida, somewhat bigger. Tyre and Sidon were bigger. But what about Arimathea, Aenon, Bethphage, just a little village outside Jerusalem? Caesarea, Philippi, you could know about, all right. But some of the others aren't so easy to know about. Now, if someone wanted to make up a story and they're in Rome, they can go to bookshops. But would a bookshop in Rome tell them the names of Palestinian villages, Jewish villages? I mean, what would be the sense? You know, you might have some great survey of geography that would tell you the great places in the world to go and visit, but what would be the use of documenting villages? If someone were in Turkey, in Syria, how would they know this sort of information? If they were in Egypt, how can you know this anywhere but actually the land? There are no maps that would bother to document villages. In fact, probably people just in Jerusalem didn't really care much about the names of the villages outside. It's only the villages themselves, and probably no road signs as well, because after all, anyone who ever needs to go there knows the name of the village. So how do you get this sort of information? But then we can consider the fact that when we contrast the four Gospels, just on the questions of towns and villages, they each have about 12 to 14 names, total of 23 different ones. The Gospel of Philip, on the other hand, which is, by the way, the text to which is attributed this bit from which people try and have this idea that Jesus had a relationship with Mary Magdalene. This is a 3rd century, maybe 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century manuscript. Simon can talk about, get all the facts right that I've got wrong. But what does it know about geography? Well, it only names two places. One is Jerusalem and one is Nazareth. And of course, it thinks Nazareth is Jesus' middle name. So in terms of places correctly located, it's only got one, Jerusalem, the capital, which of course, anyone, anywhere would have been able to hear about, even if you were in Rome. What about the Gospels of Peter and the Saviour? One town each. What's the town? Jerusalem. What about the other 2nd and 3rd century Gospels? What towns do they know? None. So the total of 16 2nd and 3rd century Gospels, you look at how many correctly placed towns do we have? One, Jerusalem. So they in fact become part of the argument for Christianity, because they show what happens when you make up a story. You see, the Gospels aren't the made up ones. Then I want to say, well, let's look at the number of words per Gospel. Well, you know, give those other Gospels their due. They're short, so they don't maybe have much chance to have talk so much. So you see the Gospel of Philip, Thomas, Judas, Peter and Mary there on the right, and Matthew, Mark, Luke, John on the left. I want you to fix your eyes on those four left-hand columns. Fix your eyes on the columns, four left-hand columns, four Gospels, and we'll change slide. I've changed the number of place names per Gospel, not just town names, also places like Golgotha and river names and everything like that. What you find is, go back, there's the number of words per Gospel, here's the number of place names per Gospel. Do you notice there's a big, the drop-off? You know, those other five Gospels don't really care much or know much about geography. But the other striking thing is, of course, that the four Gospels have exactly the same proportion. So if I do that, place names as a proportion of length, how many place names per 1,000 words? I find all four Gospels have a remarkable feature. They basically all have about five names per 1,000 words in Greek. You could do this in English Standard Version, I did this, and they have between 4.6 and 4.9 place names per 1,000 words. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is something you could do at home. Okay? Just, you know, it's very simple. You just get a computer, I mean, computer people will be able to do it more easily. Just get the computer text of the four Gospels, strip out, just take the capital names, strip out all the things that aren't place names, and then work out as a proportion of words. You'll get roughly the same stats. How do all four Gospels end up with the same proportion of words? Place names. I've got an explanation. Just like this. Luke said to Mark, "Mark, how many words have you got in your Gospel?" Mark went through carefully counting the words by hand, of course. A little bit difficult because manuscripts back then didn't generally divide between words, didn't generally have spaces. But, you know, he ploughed through and he counted them all. And then once he'd finished that, Luke said to Mark, "Mark, but how many place names do you have?" And so Mark calculated that. And then they did a bit of, they did their sums, and they tried, then Luke replicated that same proportion. John and Matthew heard about this. They thought, it's a great idea. We could do this too. And so they all get the same, this is not the same number, this is the same proportion of place names. No, I don't think that's a very good explanation. On the other hand, do you think they would end up with the same proportion if they were simply putting in place names to make the story look authentic? Ooh, I need a bit of authenticity now. Better put some place names in. Villages, that will make it sound really real. Better put some of those in. Again, it doesn't really explain it. But if people simply record things as they happened, as people told them to do, and they put in what something's called as its relevance, is it possible that when their narratives get long enough, they're going to have roughly the same proportion? I mean, it's not that they're all evenly spread. Matthew has no place names in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 to 7. But over a long enough narrative, you end up, if it's the same sort of stuff, having roughly the same sort of numbers of words. So again, what this says is the Gospels are rooted in knowledge of real places where real events took place. And the other Gospels aren't about real space-time events at all. And we'll look at that a little bit more. Let's do another test, but I want to test you. Anyone know the story of Zacchaeus, little man? Yeah? He climbed up a tree. What sort of tree was it? Sycamore tree. Anyone sing it for me? Okay. The question is, okay, this is a more difficult question than the sycamore tree. That bit was easy. At least you sung that song in Sunday school or something. What town was he in? Jericho. I heard from more than one place. Jericho. So what's the question we're going to ask? Are there sycamore trees in Jericho? Right? That's the very simple test. Because a writer ought to, you know, be able to get that right. And here we have one. In fact, there are two people in there. You can see, you know, two men standing in there. A great tree to climb in. Now, the question is, how does Luke know there are sycamore trees in Jericho? I have two possible explanations. Either he has been there, or he's talked to someone who has been there. Anyone else got any other explanations? Google. Yeah. But I mean, really, this is the sort of detail you just know. But then the question is, where are sycamores? Well, here I turn to the most authoritative source that I could. This is not the sycamore which we have in Britain or that there is in America. This is Ficus sycamoros. Where does that occur? I could find no other place than Wikipedia. And where does it occur? Well, funnily enough, both now and in antiquity, this thing was not in Turkey, it was not in Greece, it was not in Italy. So guess what? Someone living in those countries probably wouldn't even have heard that there was such a thing as sycamore. So you can say something about where the writers got their information from based on details like that. Now let's bring some tests together. Because you might say, well, okay, that shows that there's some general reliability to the Gospels, but what about the miracles? Aren't they all made up? Well, I hope that the argument works a bit like this, that to have the miracles made up and the other bits right can run into problems. And the reason why is if you want the miracles to be made up because people gradually change and exaggerate stories as they're passed from mouth to mouth, you know, through lots and lots of steps, probably there weren't lots of steps because of the high quality of information. You'd have to have a mechanism of getting distortion in one area, namely miracles and exaggeration, while having preservation in another area. That's the problem. But let's look at the feeding of the 5,000 together and see whether we can see whether there's any reliability to this. Firstly, the question of numbers. I mean, we know that people exaggerate numbers. I mean, there are 1,000 people in this room, and all the events that churches run are always so very well attended, and so on. I mean, surely, how would we know that, you know, there were 5,000 men? I mean, isn't that just a number plucked from the air? They looked at them, 5,000. Yeah, that'll go down in our prayer letter. Well, actually, you look at Mark, and Mark tells you that Jesus commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass, and so they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. They sat down in numerical groups. Or as it puts in Luke, there were about 5,000 men. He said to his disciples, have them sit down in groups of about 50 each. So they sat down in these numerical groups, which in fact makes it rather easier to count them. Gives you around 100 groups if they're all groups of 50, 50, that's about 8 per disciple, which I think most of the disciples could count to 8 because they'd done it with fish. And that was helpful. So they had a bit of practice. And fish is a man's new job. Then the question is, what about the actual story itself? I mean, surely you can't believe that Jesus fed 5,000 men, plus the women and children, with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Well, let's have a look at that. There are some interesting details in this story. Firstly, the Mark tells you there's green grass, and John tells you there's much grass. Now, maybe that's just an eyewitness makeup. Someone's made it up to make it look authentic. Bit of green in there. Need green in the picture. Or is it an eyewitness detail? How can we tell? Then we have the question, the fact that Mark says there were many people coming and going, but he doesn't tell you why many people were coming and going. But John tells you it's Passover time. Now, those two details, in fact, dovetail together. because what you find is one explains the other. People were coming and going because, of course, people used to travel to go to Passover. But John doesn't tell you lots of people are traveling, and Mark doesn't tell you many people are coming and going. One of my pleasures in Aberdeen, when I was lecturing there, was to be the prosecutor for plagiarism. And I used to make sure that all the appointments were 9 a.m., so that they were really worried the night before, and people would come in very smartly dressed. And the question was, what's happened in terms of explanation? How can we explain the similarity between these two pieces of work? And people would come up with various stories, and there were ways of showing the plausibility or implausibility of these stories in terms of whether someone was the victim, as could happen. Someone could have their computer stolen and have an essay nicked. These things happen. And you can actually tell. And one of the ways you tell is just, are there little bits in those stories that are so small, so subtle, that agree with something you know outside, that it's very hard to imagine how you can make it up. Whereas the liars usually show themselves pretty clear. And here we've got this sort of feature in the Gospels, that one tells you many people coming and going, and one, it was Passover time, but they don't draw attention to it anymore. It's an undesigned coincidence. Then you've got the fact that Jesus turns to Philip and asks where to buy bread from in John's Gospel, but then in John's Gospel, Philip replies, and then Andrew replies. Why does Jesus turn to Philip? Well, Luke tells you that the feeding took place near Bethsaida, and John tells you that Philip and Andrew were from Bethsaida. So, if I read through John's Gospel, I see no significance whatsoever to why Jesus turned to Philip. If I plug in the geographical information from Luke, then I can make sense of it. Jesus turned to a man with local knowledge. And a man with local knowledge and another man with local knowledge got involved in the reply. This is the sort of thing that's going on in this context that looks to me like a memory. That's so subtle, the agreement, you can't possibly say people wrote it like that so that later on people would read it and realize it was true. Because after all, a lot of people have been reading the Bible and never noticed that. Anyone here not noticed that before, been reading the Bible for a while? And then even the little bit that they were barley loaves fits exactly with the fact that you've got Passover. Because at Passover, you've just had the barley harvest. But then we've got the question, would the grass have been green? Well, look at a precipitation chart from a nearby town. You see, Passover, coming up to Passover, would have been, would have been coming around April and the 10th, in the years surrounding here. You've just had that sort of time. You've had 5 or 6 of the months of greatest precipitation in the whole year. Would the grass have been green? You bet. So, in other words, these sort of details fit with it being true. So what do we make of all this? Well, there are 2 talking animals in the Bible. I don't really have noticed that. There's the donkey, Balaam's donkey, and the serpent. The funny thing is that the one is proverbially stupid and the other one is proverbially clever. The one that's proverbially stupid gets it right and the one that's proverbially clever gets it wrong. But anyway, people have 2 ways of explaining early Christianity away. One is to say the Christians were really, really, really clever and they schemed and they did it like that. The other one is the Christians were really stupid and bungling and that's how it all changed, the incompetence. And let's just realize these 2 methods of explanation are fundamentally in tension with each other. Yes, you might be able to combine a bit of each, but really it's going to be hard to know how you can make them both work together. And as a Christian, all that I'm commending to people is not the idea that Christians were either particularly clever or particularly stupid, but maybe they were just somewhere in between, like maybe normal, and just reporting what they saw. To me, I can't prove that explanation, but I can say it really looks natural. It really seems to fit with what I see when I read the New Testament and I read the other ancient documents. Thank you very much for listening. And time for questions. Hello.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. Absolutely fascinating stuff. And I'm sure we'll all be going home and counting the number of place names in our Bibles before tomorrow. And we do have time for maybe just one. I'll give you one question, so make it a doozy. Has anybody got one question that they think's a good one to start us off? No takers.
There's one at the back.
Gordon at the back. Is there a wee mic for you there? Hold on. Hold on, hold on.
Hello. Hello. Yeah, is it correct that Tacitus wrote that Jesus was not of a virgin and Mary had an affair with a Roman soldier and that his miracles were Egyptian sorcery, or was that a different writer?
No, that's not Tacitus. It's Jewish sources, which are quite a bit later, right, which talk about Jesus with a surname Ben, son of Pandera, I think that's right. Great to have some experts to check on the things. At which then some people came and made up an explanation. Who was it who invented the German soldier, that Mary had an affair with the German soldier thing? Celsus. So Celsus is late 2nd century pagan critic of Christianity who comes up with the explanation. In other words, you're talking way, way later than the sources we're talking about.
Thank you.
Yeah, but it's been around for a while. I mean, you know, you've got to explain this guy's origin, and so that's what was used. But no, Tacitus, Tacitus, this is the only reference he has to Christianity, and he's no supporter of Christianity, but really he seems to me to show a lot of details that fit.
Thank you.